Welcome to Your Money Today, a unique look at financial, geopolitical, and other news relevant to you. For 45 years now, your host, Chris Temple, has provided his one-of-a-kind insights and advice on the markets and on our world. Whatever the subject, he calls them like he sees them. Roll up your sleeves with Chris as we get into today's program.
Welcome into the first edition of Your Money Today for 2025. I've been doing a lot of appearances on everybody else's podcasts, it seems, for the last couple or 3 weeks, especially, except my own. But as promised, we're going to wrap a lot of that up into one overall bow for you today, and that is on my 2025 theme of Let's Do the Math, as you saw during the introduction. You know, there's a lot of opinions, there's a lot of hopes and fears out there. You've got people that are saying that finally, with Donald Trump getting back into the White House and with Biden on his way out and his team and so forth, you know, we're going to have a great opportunity to make America great again, as we've heard a zillion times in recent months. On the other side of the coin, you've got some people, and a lot of this starts out from a preconceived opinion, largely of the president-elect and soon to be 47th president, that they think things are pretty bad, and that we got to look out or be ready to run for the hills in 2025. But we're going to do something that I always try and do, and that is to be as unpartisan as possible, as unopinionated as possible. I certainly have my opinions, but they've got to be supported by facts, and that's the thing that we always are trying to inculcate here at the National Investor and at Strategic Media and on Your Money Today. And that is, we can get information and opinions everywhere. They're all like, you know what, but we need knowledge and we need facts. And in this exercise, largely, as I'll repeat along the way, we're going to do the math. So before we get into this, please, a reminder to like this video, if you'd be so kind, share it with your friends, subscribe to this channel, because there's a lot more that's going to be coming in the following weeks and months as I break down a lot of the individual pieces you're going to see. I have already this year talked a lot about different market sectors, one of them in an interview I did on uranium with Scott Melby, that hopefully you saw. If not, it's on my YouTube channel. We've talked about energy a lot already. Imminently, not long following your seeing this video, you're going to see first a video and then a print version of a special issue on the precious metals. Here's the working cover of that right now that we're putting together. A lot of the companies I like in all of these spaces are already profiled as well on my YouTube channel. Profiles of the companies, updates as the case may be. So spend some time there to see the ones that are on my list, those companies that I like. Now, as we're doing this on Friday, the 10th of January, we've already seen a lot of changed attitudes on Wall Street in some respects, and in others, we're seeing kind of accentuated moves of what we've seen already. The U.S. dollar has hit a new all-time high, actually successive ones for the last few months on a trade-weighted basis. The dollar index was tickling 110 this morning, which is the first time it's been there in quite a while. We're seeing a stock market sell-off, though most of it came early in the morning. Interestingly, with both interest rates rising, they spurted it up, and the dollar, we've seen a pretty strong day for commodities. We're going to talk about all of this and more as we go along, but again, we're going to do it clinically, and we're going to do it from a standpoint, as you see from this great Hedge Eye cartoon. I like to use theirs once in a while besides my own, and of course give them credit. It's going to be all about a math lesson. Now, as Trump 2.0 gets underway in another 10 days following the inauguration, I think that we need to look at a number of instances where the math is simply not going to be friendly to President Trump and to his agenda. And that's not a partisan statement, it's a matter of fact, and again, it's a matter of simple math. And I want to start real quick, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on quote politics, but on the simple fact that beyond all the hyperbole and exaggeration, especially from partisans of either the GOP generally or President Trump specifically, and make no mistake, I want to see him and this country succeed, no question about that. But this was not, this last election, while it has the Republicans in nominal control of everything, the White House, the House, and the Senate. It's by a razor-thin margin, as we all know. This was not exactly a landslide. Yes, President Trump did better, certainly in the popular vote, than a lot of people thought. But the fact is that there are scant majorities in both houses. And already, when it comes to trying to enact some of the big measures the president wants to do on the border, on energy security, on making permanent the tax cut legislation from 2017, and on so much more, you've got very different minorities of Republicans in the House and in the Senate that are arrayed really against one another, as well as alternately against the president. For example, House Speaker Johnson has said that he's going to try and do one single, what is called a reconciliation bill, and I'm sure if you follow the news at all, you've heard that term. It's a measure where if stuff that Congress is trying to get enacted deal specifically with spending and taxation measures, or you can massage the issue to make it appear that way, then you don't always need a majority, because don't forget that more often than not, simple majorities are not enough in the Senate. You sometimes need 60 votes for a lot of different things. But through this reconciliation process, I won't get any deeper into the weeds on the details than I just did. You can do 50% plus one in both bodies. But here's the problem. In the Senate, John Thune, the majority leader, who incredibly, but not shockingly, as soon as he got that job from his colleagues, put right back in charge Mitch McConnell as head of the Rules Committee, so he determines what comes up and what doesn't before the Senate to a great extent. He has already warned that don't hold your breath, first off, for one big, beautiful bill, which is what the president said he wants. He wants everything in it, get rid of the debt ceiling, everything, all in one fell swoop. All right, John Thune has pretty much said forget about it. He also has suggested that when it comes to extending or making permanent the tax cuts from 2017, which of course is a big part of President Trump's desired agenda, that he's not sure that they're going to be able, even in a second vote this year, if it goes according to the way he sees things, he's not sure he can even come up with enough spending cuts to offset that, which means that it's a non-starter in the House, because you've got about 30 or 40, depending on the specifics of the of this particular legislation, Republican members who actually do take seriously the promise that we're going to whittle down the size of government, bring costs down, and we're going to work toward a balanced budget. And they will not vote for what John Thune says is doable in the Senate. So this is going to be very messy. And one of the things I think coming into this year, and I've warned about this repeatedly, is that the markets, first of all, were in la-la land where the Federal Reserve and inflation and interest rates are concerned. We're going to get to that quickly. But they were also in la-la land as to this euphoria following the election results that think that there's going to be some magical quick way to reduce regulations, reduce banking regulations and reserve requirements, do better for permitting when it comes to energy and other projects. We'll talk about that as well in a little while, etc. And it's just not going to be as easy as some people are thinking. And that's why in recent days, more and more, including as I'm recording this, we're seeing the stock market especially start to wonder, well, gee, are we betting on a pie-in-the-sky scenario that's not going to happen? And are the gains we've seen as good as it gets? Because I would suggest that as far as the broad market is concerned and sentiment, yes, things are. This is about as good as it gets. Now, I want to talk first, as far as a broad subject, about monetary mathematics. And by that, we're going to discuss alternately the U.S. dollar, which has hit a new all-time trade-weighted high in recent months, continues to add to that. It's hit a new high on the U.S. dollar index versus other key currencies today due to the strong jobs number, etc. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about inflation expectations, which have gone back in the wrong direction, and long-term interest rates, which have gone the wrong way. All of these things, but especially the outlooks for inflation and interest rates, are as they are because of the overwhelming perception which President Trump can legitimately disprove, along with Congress, if he comes up with a policy. So I'm not ruling out that possibility. But aside from that, everybody assumes that the Trump agenda, before it makes a dent in it, is going to add several trillions of dollars more to the national debt because of extending and making permanent tax cuts, because of all the deregulation, because of renewed declines in some interest or tax rates, etc. A lot of this is warmed over trickle-down economics, which if you do accompany that with legitimate spending reductions and you have legitimate pro-growth policies to broaden the economy, can work. I mean, and a lot of us have never said otherwise. The trouble is history, every single time you look at instances like this, says it doesn't work. The first president I voted for in my life was Ronald Reagan in 1980, presidential candidate, who became president. And one of the first things he did, as a lot of you old enough to recall, was to appoint what was called the President's Private Sector Survey on Cost Control, otherwise known as the Grace Commission. That was an easier line and title to remember. They came up with, over about 18 months or so, what today would have been several trillion dollars worth of reductions in spending and waste and fraud in the federal government. Virtually none of it got enacted. So while the Reagan tax cuts of the early part of his term indeed did dramatically increase the volume of revenue to the federal government, so there is, the Laffer curve does work. If you cut tax rates, you broaden economic growth and the amount of dollars that comes in goes up. But the problem then and the problem since then, every single time, is that spending goes up faster. Nobody, including Donald Trump during Trump 1.0, has figured that out yet. That you don't take a scalpel to these things, you take meat cleavers, you get rid of entire agencies that shouldn't be there, you whittle the military and industrial complex and a deep state and all of this stuff down to size. Trump promised to do that during his first term. He did not. I hope that's going to change because of some of the better company he's keeping these days, but that remains to be seen. But until proven otherwise, the overwhelming consensus of the markets is correct, and that his policies are going to lead to, certainly inflation is not going to drop any further. It'll probably go up. Yes, we may get some broader continuing economic growth for that, but the bond market is going to enact a hell of a price for that as well, and we're seeing that. When I get to China in a short time, which is a very interesting subject, and as I'll say when we get there, the single biggest macroeconomic factor we can watch this year is the U.S. versus China dynamics on so many levels. But the interest rates here in the U.S. have done something that they've only done one other time in any of our lifetimes. And that is, as the Federal Reserve, starting last fall, has cut short-term interest rates now by 1 full percent, or 100 basis points. Long-term interest rates have gone up now by more, as of today, than 100 basis points from their bottom back around that same time in September. The only other time that happened was back, I think it was in 1980 or 81, and Paul Volcker, who had already jacked up interest rates a lot, started cutting the federal funds rate, fearing that he was overdoing things, and that was proven correct with the kind of recession we had in 81 and 82. But initially, the bond market didn't believe that inflation was back under control. And so for a while, when Volcker cut interest rates on the short end, the bond market sold off, and the bond market vigilantes, who were, you know, full-throated again these days, they sold treasuries until after a little while they realized, oh, okay, I guess Volcker's right, and inflation has been tamed enough that we don't have to demand these big double-digit premiums for U.S. debt. So, but that's where we're back today. The market is smelling, and correctly so, that on the inflation trajectory, we're kind of where we are right now after in the 1970s, Fed Chairman Arthur Burns for a while relented on raising interest rates from the early through the mid-70s, lowered them for a while, but then inflation took off again. He had to reverse course and start raising more, and then Volcker came in and finished the job. A lot of people believe we're back about at that same place right now. Maybe not with the magnitude of a reacceleration of inflation in front of us, but the pattern is going to be the same, and thus the same as far as long-term interest rates are concerned. So as the president is trying to sell everybody on this idea of extending the tax cuts and doing this and that without immediate, bona fide, legit offsets to that, is that you're going to hear that term offset a lot when it comes to the banter back and forth between the House and the Senate. He's probably not going to get a majority immediately for even the tax legislation part of any kind of a big, beautiful bill. It might be a two or three, instead of a 10 on a scale of 10, maybe we'll get two or three fives or sixes between now and the end of the year, because this is where it's going to bog down. And this has happened before, you know, before the election, when I was having so many conversations about this, I was pointing out that, look, whatever you think about Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, the fact is that whoever wins is going to be inheriting a god-awful mess. They're going to be stepping into something where the math is so much against them, it's going to be like Carter, who we just buried yesterday, or I had the funeral for yesterday. It's going to be like Carter was when he came in 77, and already the inflation of the last part of that decade was baked into the cake. He didn't have a damn thing to do with that. It was already there when he got there. More recently, you've got the example of President Clinton when he first came in 1993. And it was a time that you had kind of a weird combination back then of a stagflation that had been percolating. The bond market was rebelling back then. And, of course, his big henchman, James Carville, famously quipped around those times that, you know, I always thought that if reincarnation was true and I can come back as something, I'd want to come back as a 400 hitter in baseball or maybe the Pope. But I changed my mind. I want to come back as the bond market because you can scare the hell out of everybody, control everybody, dictate what they do and so forth. And indeed, back in the first part of Clinton's term, a lot of his liberal agenda, social spending and whatnot that he had wanted to do, none of it got done because of the dictates of the bond market. And then later, of course, from 94 on, it was because of the Republican opposition in Congress. So this is what Donald Trump is facing where it comes to bonds and so forth. And, you know, recently there's been this idea, and I'll talk about this a little bit later with the stock market, but there's just been this idea and this narrative of U.S. exceptionalism. We're the prettiest horse in the glue factory in so many ways compared to the messes in the rest of the world. But look, it's the sheer volume of debt. You know, we're at $36 trillion and rising as far as the acknowledged total U.S. national debt. That doesn't include, according to most people's numbers, a lot of off-budget sheet stuff, a lot of long-term liabilities for different things that aren't counted. Whatever it is, that's the official number. We're going to add the better part of $3 trillion to that in the current 2025 fiscal year. And yeah, there's nobody suggesting that the U.S. is going off into the dustbin of history tomorrow or next week or next year, that we're going to default on debt or anything like that. But because of the sheer volume of it and how much more we're adding to it, the funding requirements are going to dictate that the U.S. is going to have to pay up more for it. And it's noteworthy that even more so than the U.K., that has got a bigger budget crisis right now and where interest rates have shot up, no major economy on the planet has to pay higher interest rates for long-term money than the U.S. does. And that's what Donald Trump has to reckon with. How he's going to square that circle remains to be seen, but that's what the market is dictating. You know, the other thing we've got to look at too on this, as far as the math is concerned, is the U.S. dollar, which I mentioned a few minutes ago, because the dollar at its current level is choking. It's taking the oxygen out of the room for emerging market nations who have external debts denominated in U.S. dollars. That could cause a crisis at some point somewhere. We've seen it repeat from time to time. But the interesting thing right now is you don't really see anything in the near term that's going to take the dollar down, certainly in comparison to monetary policy elsewhere, because if anything now, we've gone from the hope of another four rate cuts on a short end by the Fed in 2025 to now probably none, And it's a coin flip whether before the end of the year the Fed raises rates again, as I alluded to a minute ago, rather than cuts them some more. So that's going to keep a lot of wind in the sails of the U.S. dollar because everybody else is kind of a mess. They've got lower interest rates now. They may continue to cut. The economies are in worse shape elsewhere. And what's going to be really interesting to watch, and I'm not going to spend any time speculating too much on it today because we've got to wait until after the inauguration when the president's words mean a bit more than they do now ahead of the inauguration. But what does all this mean for Trump and his mercantilism policy for wanting to have the U.S. more competitive with our own exports, which during Trump 1.0, he was always pining for a weaker dollar, for negative interest rates even from time to time compared to what they were back then, where Europe and Japan were concerned, where some interest rates were even negative. You know, the guy is not the biggest fan of monetary restraint that we ever have had in the White House. So it's going to be interesting to see what he does or doesn't do to try and talk back down the dollar or achieve that through some kind of policy. I said in one of my earlier Your Money Today podcasts back late last year and on other shows that it's going to be a losing game if he gets in this public pissing contest against Jerome Powell because it's one he's not going to win. So what does he do? That's something, a subject for another day, although I'll just throw this one teaser out. And that is, as I was speaking just a little while ago today to a friend and colleague up in Canada, you know, if you have a strong dollar, whether it's justified or not, and you're kind of king of the hill right now and want to take advantage of that while you can, not a bad time to make a play for Greenland. Not a bad time to try and make a deal to have a bigger control over Canada, which has got its currency going in exactly the opposite direction. No, not forever. I think once the, you know, Trudeau's agonizingly slow exit is done and there's better leadership there, I think the loonie will take care of itself. And I'm actually very bullish after that on Canada and the loonie both. But you look at Greenland, you look at Panama, you look at a lot of other things, and it's not going to shock me if Trump's tune doesn't radically change where the dollar is concerned. So that's something we'll cover another time. You know, those of you who have followed me for any length of time know that in addition to others' really well-done graphics, I've had my own cartoonist for a lot of years who's done some great work. They're very memorable on so many subjects, and this is one he did for me a short time ago where I was poking fun at Fed Chairman Powell, and we could have easily as used President Trump for this, or President Biden for that matter, or the Secretary of the Treasury, Yellen, whoever, take your pick. But thinking that things are rosy when a lot of stuff is about to hit the fan. That was a pretty memorable cartoon a few months back. But if those of you watching by video and able to see these, if there's one that gets burned in your mind today as the single biggest macroeconomic factor that we have to follow, it's this one right here. Comparing interest rates in China with interest rates in the U.S., and more so the reasons why this is so. This is an historical aberration. This has never happened before, at least since China's had public bond markets that people could quantify, where you have this wide of a gap. You know, you've got, as of today's close, I think we were around 4.73 or 4, something like that on a 10-year treasury, so up even from this number. In China, for them to borrow money for 10 years, it's more like 1.6%. What does that tell you? And it's not just on long-term debt. If you look at across the yield spectrum with Chinese paper, everything has been trending downward. That tells you that quite contrary, couldn't be more contrary, to the remaining, if not strengthening, inflationary impulses in the U.S. markets, the U.S. economy, and so forth, you have deflationary impulses in China that over the last really few years now have been taking increasing hold. And that's going to be an intractable problem for the world, number one. Number two, it's going to be an intractable problem for President Trump to get on top of, where he hates the fact that China, our key competitor really on the planet these days, but one, as I've explained many times before, of the West's own making, just like the old Soviet Union was once upon a time. This competitor has a $1 trillion trade surplus with the rest of the world. The lion's share of that, as we all know, with the U.S. He hates it. He wants to do away with it. He's threatening more tariffs. He's threatening all kinds of measures. But someone's going to need to explain to him, hopefully soon, that we are on such different playing fields with the dynamics of our respective economies that I don't care what tariffs he puts on a lot of imports from China. It does not solve the economic and market equation, first off, for that country, which is fighting off deflation. They have massive overcapacity, and the only way they keep from completely imploding and taking all of us with them, at least for a while, is by continuing to sell, and increasingly so, their cheap goods every place that they possibly can. Now, you need to understand that the abuse of debt, and it's comical, and this is something I've talked about many times, and this is why folks need to get away from political labels. I mean, every time I turn on Fox News, I'll bash the Republicans and their supporters for a while. Everything about China is the CCP, the CCP, the CCP this, the CCP that. The CCP is the biggest danger to mankind. What does CCP stand for? Chinese Communist Party. From an economic standpoint, China has been anything but communist in the way it has run its markets and banking system for about the last 20 years. They have been more Keynesian than anything John Maynard Keynes ever thought of. They make Alan Greenspan, who is the mad monetary scientist of all times in the U.S., for the turmoil he caused back when, they make him look like a veritable Scrooge of banking and intervention when you see the abuse of debt and cute derivative instruments and all these kind of things in China that have led that country to running up the biggest debt to GDP ratio of anybody in human history. A lot of people still incorrectly tag Japan with that. Not true. And China's debt to GDP ratio is triple that of the U.S., although again, as I alluded to earlier, the volume is not the same. But in proportion to their economy, nobody has abused debt like China has done. It was bad enough back in 2008 when, in this country, the abuse of largely mortgage debt led to that financial crisis and everything fell down for a while and so forth. That's nothing compared to what China has done with their entire economy, their entire industrial base, everything. You know, another analogy that's been used is the U.S. oil patch. Following 2008, when the shale boom came along and everybody and their brother in the oil patch took on all kinds of debt they wanted in on it, everybody got out over their skis, led to overcapacity and overproduction for a while, and prices collapsed, companies evaporated and died. And today, that brings us capital discipline. I'm going to talk about that in just a second, too, because that's another part of the math problem here that the president is especially out to lunch on, in my opinion. So China is dealing with a mess. And the only question is whether there is an utter and sudden collapse in China, which again would take everybody with them for a while because of all of the interconnectedness over the whole world, supply chains, banking, debt, letters of credit for shipping goods, you name it. We're all interconnected. Or whether they're going to continue to muddle through in such a way that we avoid that kind of a crisis. But even in that context, folks, the math doesn't work for the U.S. in any way, shape, or form to be able to remotely compete. Now, look at the EV industry. I'm just going to use that as an example. And one of the other separate issues I'll be dealing with following this is going to be looking at commodities alone, you know, EVs and otherwise, and where things stand there. But we are not yet at a place, though things have been going in the right direction as far as some raw material costs and battery costs, therefore, and things like that. We cannot compete on an even playing field with China. No question about it. It's just a matter of fact, and again, a matter of mathematics. China already, in much of the world, mostly in Europe, they have got yards full of unsold BYD vehicles. A lot of the cheaper models they can sell for 12 grand, give or take, I've read. Now, the president of Mexico, Ms. Sheinbaum, suggests that Mexico is going to start producing their own vehicles down there, their own EVs, that they can make for even less and sell them to Mexicans or sell them to the U.S. market, as the case may be. You know, Trump can put all kinds of tariffs on it, just like Biden put tariffs on those as well. But what industry to this point still do we really have to protect? I mean, we're still in the baby stages, if we follow through with it, of building our own complete from the ground to the showroom supply chains for these things. And until we have those, we don't really have industries to protect. So all we're doing is just raising costs for everybody. And this is where there's going to be some decisions to be made by the president later on, is how are you going to do this? Or is he going to be so belligerent in dealing with China that he pushes them off a cliff economically, which the U.S. has probably got the power to do, but then the cure is worse than the disease? I said many times that one of the things I praised Trump for during Trump 1.0 was that whereas the deep state has been pining for wars against both Russia and China for a long time, under Biden they got their proxy war with Russia so far, which I hope Trump is able to bring to a conclusion or help bring to a conclusion. He resisted also getting into a war with China. His, you know, right or wrong, he's kind of, you know, tunnel vision. It's all about business and all about the deal. And he really didn't want to look, and doesn't, I think, as a matter of his nature, look at China first and foremost as a military opponent. But the problem is he has had people around him that do. I think that's less of an issue this time, but it's still there. And I've warned that even when it comes to tariffs and economic policy, one wrong move and we tip China over. Don't forget that when a similar mindset existed in Washington behind the President Reagan, that we were going to get rid of the Soviet Union by outspending, really outborrowing them, on this arms race we had back in the 80s, we'll enrich all the defense contractors, but in the end we'll bankrupt the Soviet Union. Yeah, that pretty much worked. And later, as the dust was settling, you had a currency crisis in Russia, but none of that really had a big impact on the global economy, because in those days, the Soviet economy, as a percentage of the global total, was barely a rounding error. Today, you've got people for years who have wanted to try and do the same to knock China down a few pegs, and in part to curb its territorial ambitions and incursions into the South China Sea and things like this. But China's the second largest economy in the world, with trillions of dollars of debts back and forth. And if you push them over the cliff, we all go with them. You know, you're not going to be able to get that off. It's not going to be a last minute thing. Officer McClane taking the cuff off of Bonnie Bedelia in Die Hard just before she gets dragged out the window with a bad guy. There is no key for this handcuff. So we better keep an eye on this. So again, and I want to move on now to the broad stock market and some thoughts there as far as the math is concerned. There is not a more important issue you can look at right now. And there's not a more important issue where it's going to require tact and wisdom and being able to look a few steps ahead on the chessboard on the part of President Trump and his team than these diametrically opposed economic forces right now, the inflationary impulse in the U.S. and the deflationary impulse in China. How is this going to settle itself out? Now, I actually first want to address this whole drill baby drill idea that President Trump and a lot of his supporters were talking about during the recent campaign. The president made a big promise on which he hinges a lot of an associated promise to bring inflation back down, and as he repeated often, to reduce energy costs for the average American household and business by 50%. In his first 12 to 18 months. I heard both numbers from time to time. That is a mathematical and logistical and practical impossibility all the way around it, right? Let me explain why. And you don't need to take my word for it. Here's one quick example for those of you watching this, this particular graphic, where the CEO of ExxonMobil has been out a couple of different times, actually, suggesting that the president is being quite unrealistic when it comes to these kind of promises. There is no way that the energy industry itself is going to, again, as I alluded to a few minutes back, get out over its skis, take on debt, and put themselves once more in a position where they could have overproductive capacity and then a price crash for oil especially. They're not going to do that to help the president keep his campaign promises. I don't think Chris Wright is stupid enough, the energy secretary nominee who will be confirmed. He would never do that running a company, I would suspect. So let's be realistic here and understand that, as a first matter, the U.S. is the leading oil producer in the world. Now, it doesn't all get processed here. Some gets exported. We import about 4 million barrels a day from Canada because that's what our refineries need for certain applications, etc. But we're already a big oil producer. We're a big producer of natural gas, one of the world's cheapest producers of natural gas. And I think that's going to continue. I think that there might be some incremental room to further grow what has been now pretty much a flat line, but, you know, record 13.5 million barrels a day or so of oil production for the last year or better now. But in order to move that needle significantly, especially at a time when most of the shale plays that led to that boom are starting to peter out, they're leveling off or they're petering out. You know, we had peak oil one time that was warned about. That went away because of the shale boom. You know, there are some suggesting that we're getting the peak oil legitimately now because all of the easy pickings, even for fracking in most areas, have already been had. And going forward, it's going to cost more money and require a higher price. And this is the key, to incentivize energy companies to even put the money in to bring this stuff to market in the first place. So, look, I would love to see $2 a gallon gas again, instead of the $3.20 or $3.30 it is right now these days here in Northeast Florida, and I'm sure about the same more or less elsewhere, but it's not going to happen. You've had inflation in labor, what labor you can find if you're an oil or gas company. You've had inflation in every input cost imaginable pretty much, and that's not going away. Those prices aren't coming down 50% to enable the companies to reduce oil or gas prices at the wellhead by 50%. Forget about it. Labor is expensive if you can even find it. That's another impediment to thinking that we've got significant growth potential still for oil and gas in the United States of America. So the math just doesn't work here, and that's one of the big reasons why inflation is not going to flutter back down anymore and could contribute to it rising again, as what we've seen recently. So keep this in mind as well going forward, that the bond market is going to be watching all of this, and they're not going to see oil go down to $50 or $60 a barrel unless we have a financial and economic crisis and the economy careens and out of control for a while. If we continue to muddle ahead, if China does not collapse, the oil supply and demand picture in the world still supports $80 at least, give or take a little bit. That's a level at which companies with their present properties can make a decent return, but it doesn't really incentivize them to put a whole lot more into the ground. So I hate to be the bearer of bad news to the president. I suspect I'm not the only one behind closed doors who might be telling him this, but you're not going to bring energy prices down like that unless, again, the economy, by going into a massive recession, does it for you. Now, I am one who believes that as we move on to talk about the stock market, that we're going to have somewhat the pattern in 2025 that we had in 2022, when we saw the S&P 500 decline for the year by over 20%, the NASDAQ was down by over 30%, but a lot of sectors did well. Energy did well. Of course, a lot of that was augmented by Russia moving into Ukraine and that whole thing flaring up. You saw some value stocks do well back then. I think the same is going to be true in 2025 because, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, one of the ways in which I think markets have really been out to lunch for a while was this idea that the Fed was going to be on this almost unending interest rate cutting cycle now, that inflation was going to go back down to 2%, even by the Fed's massaged and disingenuous numbers, et cetera. And it's becoming ever more apparent that that is not going to happen. So that's why the bond market has pushed interest rates back up. And it's why the stock market now is starting to falter because, and look, folks, we could spend days on all of the charts, all of the history. I'm going through a few of them here on the screen for those of you watching this by video, of how overvalued the stock market is. This is only the second time in history that the whole world has been overweight in U.S. stocks like it is today. The other time, most notably, was going into the year 2000. But as I've said many times, at least back then, when a lot of foreign investors piled in, and back then also was largely into ETFs, the big cap tech stocks and so forth in 1999, it was because they deemed the U.S. markets the safest place to be if anything was true about the whole Y2K scare back then. And they figured the biggest first world market like the U.S. would get their act together and you wouldn't have any hiccups in people's accounts and ability to transfer money and so forth, and that all proved true. But at least back then, you had a date certain where you knew that the factors that were sucking people into the U.S. in 1999 was going to reverse. And that was when January 1 came and went, and we were all still here. The planes weren't falling from the sky and all the rest of that stuff. We have had a similar dynamic in the recent past with the world piling into the U.S. dollar, into U.S. stocks, and so forth. It's a little bit cloudier, however, how and what we're going to see, or what's going to happen, I guess I should say, to cause that equation to change. Why would the world, on top of U.S. investors, start pulling back out of the U.S.? Would it be because of a realization early in Trump's term that all of his agenda is not going to be passed like he hopes? That could be part of the reason. But keep in mind, too, though, on the flip side of that, and this is not without foundation, that a lot of the world wants to be in a country where capital is treated well, where tax rates are low, especially as the president has suggested, and I'm wholeheartedly behind this kind of an idea. If all of your manufacturing is done in the U.S., you get an additional break on your corporate tax rate and on your permitting or whatever the case may be within the legal constraints of that, some of which Congress will be weighing in on. Look, that's all legit. And so it's not, completely a cockamamie idea that the whole world thinks that the U.S. is the best game in town for all of our other awards, no question about it. But I think where reality also is going to start to set in even more, and we've seen tastes of it in recent days and weeks, is that the level of U.S. stocks now, when you look at earnings, when you look at the historic overvaluation compared to the book value, when you look at the fact that the S&P 500's dividend and earnings ratios are back at their extremes reached last in the year 2000, etc. The vulnerability is that baked into the cake for stock prices and sentiment generally has been this idea that the Fed is going to succeed, not only in their no landing scenario, they'll avoid a recession, and right now that looks like a pretty good bet, at least on the numbers, but that also they're going to succeed in bringing inflation down to 2%, which means that interest rates have another 1% to 2% more to fall. That ain't going to happen. And as that becomes ever more apparent, you are going to see the more expensive stocks on Wall Street repriced. You're going to see a rotation into stuff that is reasonable, which is still old energy, in my opinion, still some of the better value stocks and dividend payers. A lot of sectors, I'll be talking about a couple of them in a minute. So you do have an opportunity this year, even though I see the broad market averages declining by double digits, not necessarily a crash, but they're too high for what the real world landscape is. That's going to do just as much to open up opportunities elsewhere. And of course, that's my job, is to guide you into what sectors and what stocks to be in. I want to talk generally as we conclude about commodities of different kinds, and there's going to be a big breakdown of these subject-wise, not market-wise, But subject-wise, again, I've already covered some of these things. I'll be covering more of them in greater detail in the days and weeks ahead. But I want to just give you some idea of how I see the math and economic statistics and whatnot influencing all of these things for 2025 and probably beyond. Now, by rights, when it comes to industrial commodities especially, and I talk about this a lot from a policy perspective, you know, my advocacy for a national infrastructure bank is one example. And I've talked about this on prior podcasts. I've talked about it as a policy matter with politicians and their staff and so forth, because the math is not going to allow the traditional kind of make work or economic stimulus thing to come out of Washington as we've seen in the past. Nor, I think, as I alluded to at the beginning, the mix of Congress and competing priorities. I don't think that's going to support this either. You're going to have to do some outside-of-the-box thinking. But here's what's just frustrating as hell to me. By rights, we should have a new industrial and energy and high-tech renaissance ahead of us. We see glimmers of that with the better technology of AI. We see glimmers of that with how, for example, and one of the most bullish commodities still is uranium, how nuclear energy is properly being looked at as one of the best ways to decarbonize, to have it, you know, go toward these zero emission targets and so forth. It's clean, it's safer than it's ever been, and it makes more economic sense than most 24/7 energy sources, if not being the best choice in all of that. And I'll talk about that specifically again in just a second. But beyond that, when we look at things like nickel and lithium and copper, whether it's over EVs, whether it's over electrification, whether it's over power grids and infrastructure and all of these different kind of things, the right policy support and the right financial support should see commodities booming for the next 20 years. But we're starting 2025 in more trouble than we've been in these areas in a very, very long time. So you've got almost a tale of two cities. You've got some really good-looking commodities and commodity stories right now where the math still is of deficits of supply, strong demand. And this is key, the inability of global macro factors to hurt a whole lot. So let's go down the list of them for a few minutes. First of all, if you look here again, for those of you on video, here's a chart of how everything did in the year just passed. Boiling it all down, precious metals had a great year, energy had a reasonable, respectable year, and base metals, and especially battery metals, had another horrid year. There's a reason why that's happened, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news for those of you that are big believers philosophically in EVs or in base metals and so forth. It ain't going to change a whole lot, in my view, in 2025. There are a lot of people who agree, especially on that standpoint, where precious metals is concerned. Gold is one of my three top commodity stories for 2025. I guess you'd put silver as a 1B after the 1A of gold, because I think silver, if gold is doing really well, will follow along in sympathy. Unless there's a dire economic situation, then it may get caught up with the rest of the base metals. But I like the precious metals because they thrive in almost any scenario. And again, I'll be talking about this in great, great detail further in the days and weeks ahead through a couple of different special videos and reports and whatnot. Secondly, uranium, as I alluded to earlier, uranium is every bit as bullish today at $75 or so a pound as it was below 20 at the bear market low. And the whole world, unlike any other commodity subject, period, the whole world now, pretty much, with Germany still a minor idiotic exception, is on board with building out nuclear energy as the energy of the future, the energy that's needed in greater measure still to drive all of these AI facilities and data centers and so forth. That's a no-brainer. 3A is natural gas, and I guess I'll put crude oil at 3B. I like the fundamentals better going forward for natural gas, though we've already had a pretty darn nice move in recent weeks, as you know. Winter finally decided to show up this year, unlike the last 2 years, and that has completely upended what had been a bearish supply and demand situation, and is turning even more bullish. In fact, as I'm recording this, the weather forecasters looking out a few weeks are adding even more what are called heating degree days, where there's going to be net usage because of colder weather. So good story for those commodities going forward as well. It's slightly dated, but if any of you watching this didn't see this particular special issue of mine, you know, a funny thing happened on the way to the energy transition from last spring. Pretty funny, pretty telling. Few good stock ideas in it, which have all been doing really nicely for the most part. Just drop me a line and I'll send this to you. Now, in the near term, where base metals are concerned and battery metals, it's a negative to, at best, murky situation for, I think, quite a while going forward. First of all, China's economic woes, I don't think, are going away. Every now and then, they've been announcing new stimulus measures. Even the central bank governor of the People's Bank of China was channeling his inner Ben Bernanke not long ago, suggesting that, gee, it's about time for helicopter drops of cash on the people. They didn't go out and spend. I didn't mention this earlier, because one of the big problems that China has is that, unlike the average American consumer shop till you drop attitude, you've got frugal people over there, and if they see a shit show developing in their economy and they're going to hunker down, they're going to sit on their cash. They're going to sit on their hands. They're not going to go out and spend money just to save the powers that be from having led the whole country into unsustainable high production and so forth. So that's a terrible problem that not only China has, but the world. But that factor has been dampening, more often than not, the prices and price expectations of most commodities. I think that a lot of the noise has been overdone. For example, on crude oil, you've still got record global demand for crude oil. It's not been a disaster by any stretch of the imagination in China as far as crude oil demand. And so I think that the recent price drops that we saw a while ago, where we were getting oil back down below $70 in that neighborhood, that was just not fair. It wasn't realistic, and I think that the market has straightened itself out a bit since that time. But everywhere else you look, you know, we've still got, more places than not, oversupply, overcapacity. And look, long term, I agree wholeheartedly, especially on assets like copper, like zinc, and some others, even nickel, which may be turning as far as a sentiment as we speak today, because of a couple pieces of news now out from Indonesia. But pretty much across the board, we should be seeing higher prices in years to come, because as you go out, whatever the current dynamics are, there's just not enough of everything to go around. And that's been pretty much understood for a while. But the impediments that are in front of us are overwhelming when it comes to, and I'm going to talk specifically in the context of the U.S., and this frankly goes for Canada. It goes for the EU, although they're already such a basket case, they're about ready to run up the white flag and hold their nose and buy more China imports, because they just can't and won't do the jobs that they need as an economic bloc. But how do you square a circle? I'm going to use the example of nickel, okay? We all know, and I've talked about this many, many, many times. I mean, I first set foot on a North Met project in Minnesota's Arrowhead region, a quarter of a century ago. One of the biggest development stage battery metal projects in the U.S., nickel, copper, cobalt, platinum group metals, little bits of silver and gold, I think, in there as well, still not developed. Next door, Twin Metals, not developed. More toward the middle of the state, Talon Metals has got a very interesting project, not a huge one yet, but high grade, very interesting dynamics. You know, they're trying to get toward development stage. The global price of nickel recently, after all of these metals came down from big speculative peaks a couple or 3 years ago, the global price of nickel now is around $15,000 a ton. At $20,000 a ton, if you were certain the price would stay there, none of these are going to get developed still. You need a considerably higher price for that. Let's talk about lithium for a second. Lithium, a spodumene concentrate, was selling for something like $7,000 or $8,000 a ton at the peak. It's been cut by 90% to current prices. If it doubles from the bottom here, most such production is still uneconomical or barely economical, at least in North America. And so this is going to beg a policy question that I've talked about a number of times. I've got a whole separate interview that I just did a couple of days before this. I've sent it out to folks. It's on the Prospector News' channel talking about the National Infrastructure Bank. The U.S. has got a choice to make. Canada has got a choice to make. Both of them similarly to what the EU is looking at right now. Do we have the wherewithal to craft a thoughtful, forward-looking, ground-to-showroom, ground-to-power station, whatever, apparatus where we really wall ourselves off from China and cheap foreign competition, which we are in no position to compete against, nor should we desire to compete directly head-to-head with them if it's not necessary and if it means we can give a better life to our countries and our workers via higher wages and so forth? Are we ready to put a real wall around America economically and get the best minds together and say, okay, we don't care if on the global market nickel is $15,000 a ton. We're going to operate as if it's $30,000 a ton, and we're going to help to foster lending to the best development stage projects that are worthy to bring that nickel to bear for the U.S. market. You know, in the case of nickel, we've got one producing nickel mine in the whole country, and that's in Michigan. It's got a couple or 3 years of life left. We've got a lot of other possibilities, not just in Minnesota, but in places like Montana and elsewhere also. So are we going to do that or not? And look, again, Mr. President, you're not going to solve this intractable math problem by slapping tariffs on China and not doing anything about price certainty and economic certainty along with the permitting and other certainty in the U.S. Because look, I've said this a few times already since the announcement, and I'll say it again. I think the single best and most important appointment, the nomination that the president has made, is North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum to be the Interior Secretary. He will also be the super czar, kind of a new position, over not only Interior, but over the Energy Department, the EPA, every part of the process as far as permitting, environmental reviews, all this kind of stuff. And it doesn't mean like everything is going to be done in kind of a wanton way. We all remember years back, some of us do that are old enough, James Watt, who was the Interior Secretary for a while under President Reagan. He was hated because he was actually pro-development as well. But this is all going to be good stuff, and it's long overdue. You know, I mentioned NorthMed a few minutes ago. There's no reason at all, especially if we think we're going to be able to compete or want to compete with China and other countries. I mean, hell, I've been to Ecuador many times. I've had recommendations of projects down there. Ecuador, with the nascent mining industry, permits stuff in a fraction of the time. So do a lot of other countries compared to the U.S. and Canada. So it's going to be great. And I have no question that President Trump, Secretary Burgum, and those around them are going to work hard and fast to change this terrible permitting culture, which is detrimental to growth, detrimental to us meeting our own critical metals and battery metals and industrial metals and all the other energy needs that we have. It's starting a bit more with uranium because that's been such a powerful story. But also there, as is in the case with other metals, as this, you know, World War III over commodities continues, and we've seen Russia now embargo enriched uranium to the U.S., which we are not in a position yet to manufacture all of ourselves. That crash course is underway. We have seen China embargo antimony, other rare earth elements, and now technology for lithium processing and so forth. So increasingly, the world is going in the direction that's going to be fragmented, where different blocks are going to be on their own when it comes to these things. And I certainly do hope, because there's a lot of promise there for our country, for investors, for millions of more high-paying jobs and the rest of it, if a comprehensive approach is made. And then I'll be a whole lot more bullish on industrial commodities because of that kind of good policy than I am right now. But that aside, you need to be cautious. I've got some picks on my list, but we got rid of a lot of our broader ETF picks and base metals and industrial metals several months ago because I think things, generally speaking, though I have some individual stories like, are probably going to get worse before they get better especially if a lot of these things drop in sympathy with the stock market taking on more water. So that about does it for today's podcast and math lesson, such as it is. We're going to continue this discussion piece by piece and in the days ahead of us. Make sure, if you're not already on our list, that you avail yourself of that. Go to these sites here, the National Investor, nationalinvestor.com, yourmoneytoday.org is one that you're going to want to get used to visiting. We're going to be building that site out more in the early part of the year. Strategic Media as well, where we're going to be building out new investor education pages, current events, public policy, a lot broader menu than really what I've ever had on a National Investor page. So you're going to want to be, you know, visiting all three of them, get used to that, and to have a streamlined way to be on all three or know what's important going on all three. Make sure, of course, that you subscribe if you're not already to this YouTube channel. But follow me on LinkedIn and on Twitter. I still call it Twitter. I can't break that habit. Because anytime something is of interest at any of those three sites, you're going to find out about it through my social media pages as well. So thanks for your time and attention today. I hope you've gotten a lot of good food for thought and a lot of good math lessons. And as the year goes on, we're going to continue to focus as far as actionable investing strategies on where the math does work, as opposed to where it's kind of questionable and you want to stand aside for a while. So thanks again.
We're glad you joined us today. As always, write to Chris at nationalinvestor.com with your comments and questions. And be sure to visit yourmoneytoday.org if you haven't already. Sign up for our free alerts, notifications of new shows, and more. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.